So we're on Chav Dalet Amud Aleph, and let's just go over the Mishnah. The Mishnah records a twofold machlokes as a Reish and a Seifa. In both cases, it's a machlokes between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. And in both cases, the machlokas where there's a possibility of chazara. What are the two cases? In the first case, in the Reisha, we're talking about Dayanin. So let's say there's Reuven, the Tovea, and the Shimon, the Nitba. So Reuven presents a candidacy for Dayan of someone who is disqualified. And Shimon says, you know what? I accept. Even though technically I have every right to object because he's disqualified. But I accept. Now there are three cases in the Reisha. There's Neman Alai Ava, Neman Alai Avicha, and then Neman Alai Roe Shlosha Roe Baka. The first two cases seem to be identical. They're just variations of the same idea, and that is a Dayan who's possible because he's a Karov. So in the case of Neman Alai Ava, he's a Karov to, let's say, Shimon. In the case of Neman Alai Avicha, he's a Karov to Reuven. And the two Bali Dinim agree that they will accept the verdict of this Dayan. Now, where are the other two Dayanim? Because in the very next case, it's Shlosha Roi Bokar. So there are two possibilities here. One possibility is to say that Neman Alai Ava means he's believed as if he were three judges. This is what you might call Tarte Lareith. I don't know if you're familiar with that phrase. There are two strikes against you. You know, it's not only is that this Dayan is a Karov, but he's being accepted as a replacement for the other two Dayanim. And the reason I would be pushing that agenda is because it doesn't say Shlosha, it just says one. It sounds like we're accepting one Dayan. The other possibility is to say no. We have two Dayanim Ksherim, that objectively they're not related, and we need a third judge to make up the Bezdin. And the third judge is Apostle. So we'll discuss this at great length in Mirz Hashem as we go through the Sugya. But either way, what we do have to know is that both Bali Dinim agreed to accept the verdict of this judge who is a apostle. He's disqualified. Why is he apostle?
He's a car.
He's a car. Now, Rabbi Meir is going to say, you know what? He made that statement. He proclaimed that he would accept the judgment of someone who's apostle. But you know, he was in a mood. He was fickle. You know, he now changed his mind. And Rabbi Meir grants him the rights to be chozer bo. Now I'm going to throw out the following question. Maybe you can give me your intuitive response. What do you think? How far is Rabbi Meir willing to go? Let's say that the judgment was already handed down. The verdict was already decided. That's called Gemar Din. Would Rabbi Meir allow for Chazara even after the Gemar Din? Or is Rabbi Meir saying that Chazara is a possibility up to but not beyond Gemar Din? No, it's as long as the Dinu Dvarim is going on and they're weighing the evidence and they're in the process of deliberation, then he can say, I changed my mind. I don't want this puzzle. But maybe after the Gemara Din, that's already too late. What would you say intuitively?
Until.
Correct. And once the Gemara Din is gone, is behind us, then even a mayor has to agree. You know, that would be really interesting because let's say Shimon was being sued for 1,000 and and the Beis Din decided that he has to pay $1,000. So Shimon is going to say, no, wait, I can't accept the judgment of this judge. You know, he's my father, he's your father, I can't accept him. And that would be very cool. You know, he could get the best of both worlds, because if they pass in favor of his position against the Tovei, against Reuven, great. You know, he's not going to say a word. But if in the worst case scenario they pass against him, so that's going to influence him to say, I want to be chozer. So at that point we can't allow him to have the rights of chazor. And now we have the case of Shlosha Roi Bakar. Now, in this case, assuming that as we said before, the Gemara Din has not yet been handed down, we can really appreciate the position of Rabbi Meir, because you don't even have the beginning of a Beis Din here. The Roi Bakar are people who are not Bekiyim B'din. They don't know the law. And they're all three Psulim. So you don't even have one-third of a Beis Din here, and certainly not two-thirds of a Beis Din. You have zero. So in that case, Rabbi Meir is saying, okay, he made a statement, you know, I believe these Roi Bakar, they're intelligent people, I'll accept their verdict. But now he changes his mind. You can't hold him responsible for what he said at one moment. So in any event, whether or not two-thirds of the Beis Din are reliable and qualify for judgment, it's the third one that he's accepted, or it's all three judges that he accepted. In either case, Rabbi Meir says, Yochel Lachzor Bo. Yochel Lachzor. He can change his mind. And that is before the Gemara Din. So this whole discussion here in our Mishnah is about a case of the Baal Din who accepts upon himself a judge who is not qualified. If you take a look at the first Rashi in the Mishnah, which is approximately 15 lines up from the bottom of the page, Rashi says, Leos Dayan. Now, one of the super commentaries is the Rashash, and he says that, you know what, it doesn't have to be, logically, Leos Dayan. It could be, what would be another possible way of interpreting that Mishnah, if you didn't have Rashi, Leos Dayan. Abe, Leos Abe. Is it possible that this Mishnah is addressing a case where the Baal Din accepts a apostle as an Abe? Now, I don't think that that's going to be applicable to the last case of Roi Bakar, because it doesn't make sense that the Mishnah would introduce the word Shlosha, that we're talking about three. Nowhere does the Torah ever require three witnesses, but at least as far as the ratio, whether it's Neman Olai Abba and Neman Olai Avicha, could be, I'm accepting his testimony, even if it'll come out against me and he'll force me to pay, despite the fact that he's disqualified. So in fact, the Meiri writes, Neman Olai Abba V'Avicha Sheyia Eid. Wow. The Meiri says this explicitly. Now, why am I more impressed by the Meiri than I am by the Rashash? Because the Rashash lived in the 1900s, you know, and the Meiri lived in the 1100s, or whatever it is, the 1200s. So the Meiri is a very reliable source. Now, it goes even further. The Tosis Yontif, that his name was Heller, he's a super commentator on the Mishnayis, he claims that if you look in the Rambam carefully, in Hilchas Sanhedrin Perek Zayin, the Rambam says that we're talking about a case Sher Kiblo Oli Edus Oli Os Dayan. So the Rambam has both possibilities, and apparently both the Meiri and the Rambam reject Rashi. Rashi says that we're talking about Leos Dayan. So Tosis Yontif says, and again, I find it a little bit of a push here, but he says that Rashi doesn't mean Leos Dayan to the exclusion of Leos Eid. Rashi would also agree to the Rambam that there are two possibilities. Either the Baal Din is accepting this judge as a judge, even though he's disqualified, or he's accepting this Eid as a witness, even though he's disqualified. And the Tosis Yontif, with his great scholarship, I don't know if he was learning Daf Yomi and Masechta Nida at the time that he made this comment, But he quotes a Gemara at the end of Masechta Nida, and the Gemara says there, Kol HaKashel Ladun Kashel LaHayit, which means that the Mishnah itself at the end of Masechta Nida equates Dayan and Eid, meaning that all the specifications and the qualifications that are necessary for Dayan are equal in the case of Eid and vice versa. So therefore, says the Tosis Yontif, if you could be Makabel Aviv to be a Dayan, then you could be Makabel Aviv Leos Eid. But I would say the following, although it's true that all the disqualifications are equal for both Dayanus and Eidus, it doesn't mean that as far as a person committing himself and whether or not he can rescind that commitment to accept someone who's disqualified, whether we should apply the same yardsticks as the Rambam insists to both Eid and Dayan, I'm not sure if that equation is necessarily exact or precise, because it could be that as far as Dayan is concerned, you know, the Baal Din assumes that an intelligent person, even if he's related, is still somewhat reliable, and especially when we have two other Dayanim, if we assume that interpretation, Huak Sherim. But maybe when he accepts an aid, you know, that's already going far, afield. You know, this aid is possible, and to say that I accept his aidus, maybe that's a very flimsy statement, and even the Chachamim of Rabbi Meir would agree that Yochel Lachsa. But be it as it may, for our purposes, we should know, A, the Meiri learns that our mission applies even to an aid. Number two, that the Rambam says it's even an aid. And number three, that the Tosfos Yontif says that when Rashi mentions Dayan, he's not coming to exclude an aid. But here I want to introduce to you the words of the Rashbam. The Rashbam in Baba Basra, right, starting with the third parak and on, is the super commentary on the Gemara of Baba Basra. We don't have Rashi on Baba Basra. And the Rashbam writes that the reason why our Mishnah mentions Roe Bakar. Now, I wouldn't have even blinked. You know, if you're talking about a person who's not such a great scholar and he spends his life shepherding, so call him Roe Bakar. But the Rashbam is interested. He wants to know why it says Roe Bakar and not Roe Tzon. Now, bakar would be like cows, let's say, for example, whereas tzon would be like sheep. So, again, I wouldn't have blinked about this. What difference does it make whether you mention roe bakar or roe tzon? But he makes a big deal about it, the Rashbam. And he says that the reason why the Tana mentions roe bakar and not roe tzon is because roe tzon are considered gazlonim. Again, you don't know that a roi tzon is a gazlon, but the choshed al gezel. In other words, when the shepherd takes his sheep to graze in various fields, then inevitably, I'm using a very strong word, over dramatizing, but inevitably he grazes even in the land of someone else. And that's called gezel. And that's going to be the whole machlokus between Roe Avram, if you remember that thing. And the Karen Ora, who lived about a century and a half ago, maybe a little bit more, he wants to know what difference does it make. I mean, let's accept the Rashbam that Roe Tzon is Choshed al Gezel, and therefore he would certainly be excluded as a Dayan. But so what? I mean, if the Mishnah says that you can accept your father who's posel, his father who's posel, Roy Bakar, that are not Bekiyim Bedin, why do you want to exclude the case of Roy Tzon simply because of Roy Tzon is Choshed al Gezel? Well, why does that come into play? Comes along the Karen Ora, based on this Rashbam, with a bombastic Chiddush. And he says that the Mishnah is limited to a discussion about people who are technically posel. Let's say they're krovim, or they're technically posel because we don't know if they actually are experts in the law. But in a case of someone who's disqualified because he's a rasha, he's considered someone who violates gezel. Even the chachamim would agree to Rabbi Meir that he has the right to be chozer ba, that he can change his mind, because you talk about someone who's not just technically excluded or disqualified as a witness or as a judge, but someone who's not reliable at all. He has no credibility in a Jewish court. Now, if the Balidinim want to say, you know, we'll flip a coin and whatever comes out, heads you win and tails you lose, I lose, then that's one thing. But if they're accepting him as a Dayan, how can you accept someone who's a Dayan, who's Choshen al Gezel, comes along the Keranot, he says, that's what the Rashbam means, that the Mishnah deliberately chose Roeh Bakar to the exclusion of Roeh Tzon, because in the case of Roeh Tzon, even the Chachamim would agree that Yachol Lachzor. Interesting.
They used to have range wars in the West, in the United States, between sheep herders and the cowmen, because the sheep would come and graze on the cows, and that's why they put up barbed wire fences, keep the sheep away from them. And
what's the legal implication? I'm not talking about Psyliadus.
No. I mean, just that, you know, the same thing. I mean, they were stealing their grazing land and such, and...
Oh, a historical reality, but not illegal. You're not talking about something legal. Oh, okay. Yeah, so that's interesting that the sheep, you know, is choshen al gezel. Now, this is the Reisha. Now, we're about to learn the Sefer, which is a case where they accept not a Dayan or an aid, but we'll get into the laws of Shrua. But before I get to that, I have to share with you a kasha here of the Nemuke Yosef. And honestly, I love this kasha. I don't begin to understand his answer. Maybe you can help me with it. Gevaldig kasha. The Nemuke Yosef asks the following question. We have a principle in all of Choshen Mishpat, of all of Dini Mamonos, that a person who makes a pledge, let's say, for example, he accepts upon himself an obligation to give someone a certain sum of money, just out gratis, let's say, that's not binding. A person can change his mind up until a certain point, which I'll explain in just a moment, because, I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase, promises, promises, promises. Now, you know, I wouldn't say that you're my best buddy, and you're such an honest guy, glatt, as we say, smooth, if you promise to pay a certain sum, and then you renege on your promise. But nevertheless, I can't sue you in a Jewish court of law just simply because you made promises. And by the way, I would assume, you check me out on this, that secular law is probably very similar. But all of Jewish law and Dini Mamonos, which with regard to his chayvus, is based on what's called a kinyan. And without a maisa kinyan, it's only dvarim bi'alma. And dvarim bi'alma is, words are cheap. It means, again, you know, I wouldn't give you shishi if you promised to pay something and then you reneged on your promise, but that's not a Dini Mamonos halach. So the Ruki Yosef asks, Madua, why is it that according to the Chachamim of Rabbi Meir, Moila Kabbalah Zu Bilo Asiyas Kinyan? We have a principle that any type of hischaivus requires a kinyan. And it's interesting because the Nebuki Yosef wants to demonstrate the premise, prove the premise of his question. And he quotes a Gemara that we should have quoted ourselves, because we learned it here on Daf Vav, that the Gemara says, Pshara Tzricha Kinyan, which means that if two litigants agree to mediation, they have to make a kinyan. Otherwise, they can back out and decide that they want Ikar Din, they don't want mediation. So we see that as a general rule, as soon as you alter the rules, the regulations that govern the Dine Mamonos, you know, the way the judgment has to be handed down, then you need a kinyan. Without a kinyan, just because you made an agreement, we'll alter the rules and I'll pay you if and what, that's just words. That's just cheap. That's not a kinyan. So this kasha, the Muki Yosef, in my humble opinion, is a bomb kasha. It means that we completely undermine the Chachamim here, who say in our Mishnah Yochel Lachzor, that this is a binding commitment simply because he made the declaration that I'll accept my father as a judge or your father as a judge. That doesn't make any sense. We're missing the, you know, this is what we call Ikar Chasam and Asefer. We're missing the main element, which is Kinyan. You need a formal Maisa Kinyan, which, by the way, would be a Kinyan Sudar. He doesn't mention this. You know, when women Sadar Kiddushin, right? So you need a Hischaivus on the part of the Baal, on the part of the Makadesh, that he is Mischaiv to the Ksuba. So what happens? You get together two Eidim, and they're going to sign the Ksuba that testifies to the fact that the Chasam was Mischaiv to the Ksuba, Masayim Zuz. So what, he's just going to stand up, the Chasam, in front of two witnesses and declare, Hinani Mischaiv L'Ksuba Zu? That's not good enough. I hope no one had a rabbi at his wedding who did that. But rather, he has to get a kinyan from the chassan. He has to be mischayev with the kabbalah's kinyan. I remember my wedding, the rav pulled out a yarmulke. He had a yarmulke in his pocket. And he asked me to be mekabel kinyan with the yarmulke. Today they use a pen. I don't know the different minhagim. Vitirates. Now listen to the Namuki Yosef's answer and tell me if it makes sense to you. He says the following. Are you ready for this? I mean, for this you have to sit down. Because if you stand, you might fall off your feet. He says, Kevon she'makablim oso ledayon, once they accept this person who's disqualified as a judge, asiyas hadin hu davar yadua ubarur v'eino toli kol kach b'dayto shel hadayon. I'm going to translate the words literally, and then I'm going to try to fluff it up the way I think he means. He says that 90% of judgment is davar yadu barer. It's clear. It's objective. It's not just the whim or the decision of the dayan. V'lachein maskim b'dayto lahaknos lechavero. He says the following: when do we need a kinyan? When do we assume that words are cheap? That's only because there's no haskomas hadas. He didn't really, really come to a serious decision with all his heart and with his total will. Because, you know what? He's not going to rely on the dayan. The answer is no. He will rely on the dayan. Why? Because 90%, again, that's Berzon's phrase, 90% of the judgment is davar yadua ubaru. Now here I would add a word or two. What does he mean by davar yadua ubaru? Isn't the judge there to make a decision? What's the answer, Rav Osai? Starts with an E, ends with an E also, I think. Has a V in it.
Evidence,
right. 90% of the judgment is dependent upon the evidence. You know, a judge can't say, well, I think Reuven is right. Shimon owes him 1,000 dinrim because, you know, Reuven looks like an honest guy. But the answer is that Reuven has a shtar, Reuven has two witnesses. The whole process of judgment is just simply to accept the witnesses and to review the evidence and decide the case. Again, there's always going to be a little gray area because of this nuance and that nuance, and maybe against the shtar we have a little bit of a question. But at the end of the day, the Dayan's own personal, you know, the contribution of his own personal decision-making process is very minimal. And therefore, when a person appoints X as a Dayan, even though technically he's disqualified, that person, be that whether it's this litigant or that litigant, or Tovea, the Nitba, he has what's called Haskovas Daito, that he really wants to live up to whatever decision is handed out by this Bez. Avo b'pshara, but the Gemara backed out on Vav, where the two litigants agreed to authorize the judges to institute a mediation, a compromise of some sort. He says, Eino dover misuya, you cannot predict what the dayanim are going to decide. El hakol toli b'daito shel hadayan she'oses ha'pshara. In other words, the evidence it plays only a background music here. It only plays a secondary role. But the real decision-making process is that of the Dayanim. So you're giving the Dayanim a tremendous amount of leeway and authority to decide the case. Therefore, Eino Somek Daito Mitchila Apshara. He's not really going to rely on the Dayan unless there's a Kinyan and he objectifies his Askomas Hadas. that he has a hachlata, a complete, absolute decision and commitment to rely on the dayanim to make the right pshara. Honestly, I don't understand this in Muki Yosef, because to say that 90%, again, that's just my phrase here, but that the decision is really a davar yadua ubarur, and as if to say the dayanim are playing a secondary role, I mean, that in a sense, I don't know, that insults my intelligence about my you know, we've been learning Masechta Sanhedrin now for about 23 blot, you know, and to say that the judges are playing a secondary role, I don't know, I get very sensitive about that. I would think that the judges are invested with a certain awesome amount of authority, and that only when they qualify as judges. And we spent a lot of time speaking about Mumcha L'Rabim and Smicha and Kabbalah Ish Mipi Ish, and what exams you have to take and what knowledge you have to master. And now you're talking about Shlosha Roi Bakar. All right, they're not Roi Tzom, they're not Gazlanim. But nevertheless, they're ignorant of the law. And now we're going to say, well, I have complete reliance on these Shlosha Roi Bakar because 90% is a Dover Yadua Barer. I don't know. That's going very, very far out. So the Meiri comes up with a different approach. I'm not sure if he was aware of this, the Muki Yosef, but he says the following. That when you accept someone as a Dayan, and he's Pasul, then you need to have a Kabbalah in front of three judges, or in front of two Edim. And he says the following, that very often in Halach and Dini Mominos, we distinguish between a promise or a commitment that was made verbally privately as opposed to a public kind of commitment. And when you make a public commitment, that is a binding commitment that reflects a haskama bidaito, a complete decision. A person doesn't make a public statement of that sort, excepting in this case a dayan, unless he really has a full Gemiras Das, which now substitutes for the official formal Maisa Kinyan. And therefore the Chachamim say that because, according to this Meiri, he made this Kabbalah, accepting as it were his father, Shlosha Roi Bakar, in front of a Bezdin, or in front of two witnesses, that's already a different kind of halach, that's called a Kabbalah.
So what's the difference if somebody bids on Shlishi, and he doesn't pay? He did it in front of the whole Kehila on Kriya Torah, Shabbos, for example. So isn't that the case that it's a public proclamation?
I would say that according to the Meiri, at that point, you can actually go after him.
Yeah.
And Bezdin would be entitled to collect and confiscate that money against his will. Huh. Why? Because he made a public commitment. And the Meiri says once it becomes public, it's an absolute binding commitment, no blacks touch blacks. Because this is a Gemiras Das. It's not something that, you know, he woke up, you know, one morning and he said, you know what, let me buy Shlishi for 50 shekel. And, you know, and then he changed his mind. No. He made a public statement. Now, I want to give one or two examples of what I think the Meiri has in mind. I'm not sure. The Gemara tells us in Masechta Gittin that if a man sends a get to his wife, and as the shliach is on the way, he changes his mind, then he could be mevatel the get. But the Gemara says, again, you have to know whether this is Doraisa, Darabbanan, I'm not going into that question. I mean, obviously, this is a sugya unto itself. The Gemara says that he has to be mevatel the get in the presence of either a bezdin or two dayanin, or two eidin. That which he says privately, you know, I don't want to divorce my wife. I want to be mevatel the get. You know, I want to rescind the whole deal. That's not binding. The get has its own life of its own. But once he makes that a public declaration, which means either in front of a bezin of three or in front of two witnesses, then that bitul haget, what it's called, where he nullifies the get, is absolutely valid, and he can't change his mind. Which would mean that if he wants to divorce his wife subsequently, he's going to have to start the whole process from scratch and write a new get.
Could use the same Edim that are born with the Shliach?
I think so, as far as I remember. But now you have another sugya, which is really interesting. It's a sugya of Hefker. That's at the end of Masechta Nedarim. And the Gemara there also assumes that if a person makes a private statement that he's mafkir his nechasim, I make it ownerless, he can change his mind. But if he makes that in public, either in front of a bezdin or in front of two witnesses, is no backs. So I would quote these sugyas again. I'm just touching on the tip of the iceberg here, or not even the tip of the iceberg, to support this meiri that although generally speaking words are cheap and not reliable in halacha, you need a kinyan to back it up and objectify your decision. But the exception to the rule is when he makes that public, when he makes that declaration public, which means either in front of a bezdin or in front of two eidim. There's also a sugya in Masechta Bava Basra in the third parak about mecha. Mecha means that if you're squatting on my land, then if I claim that I never sold it to you and you have no legal rights to the land, I have to make a protest. And the Gemara there also assumes that in order for me to make a mecha that's valid, such that if he doesn't have a shtar to prove that he bought the land, even years down the line, we're going to evict him from the land, I need, as the original owner, I need to get together a bezdin or two witnesses to register my formal objection, my protest, to the fact that he's squatting on my land. So the mecha has to be b'fnei shnayim or b'fnei bezdin shel shlosha. And once again, because the mecha is not considered binding if it's made in private. Which, by the way, this is not, has nothing to do with us today, but this reminds me of the Gemara in Erechin about Lashon Hara, that if you say something in front of two witnesses, then there's no Lashon Hara. Again, there are 50 million conditions that have to be, the whole thing is theoretical, so don't take anything from this. But in the theoretical world, I mean, the Chofetz Chaim, you know, he has like 15 conditions when this applies, but the Gemara says explicitly that if you say something publicly, then it's already considered public knowledge, and if somebody repeats that slander, that evil talk, he doesn't violate Lashon Hara because he's just telling you what's on the front page of the newspapers. And the Gemara goes back and forth, what is considered public knowledge with regard to Lashon Hara? If it's enough that you said it in front of two people, maybe you have to say it in front of three people, but in any event, you know, when you talk about the Chachamim, that the Chachamim say that Eino Yochel Lachzor Bo, that when a man changes the rules and he says, I'm going to pay you even though the Dayan is possible, or the three Dayanim are psulim, and he can't rescind that agreement just because he made a verbal declaration, you know, the Mukiyosi says, how does that work? And he comes to the conclusion, because 90% of judgment is objective, it's the evidence, it's not really the Dayan. But in Pshara, it's really the Dayan who's calling the shots. And there you need a Kinyan. But the Meiri has another pshat. And the Meiri is assuming that the reason why the Chachamim say that you're not allowed, you don't have the authority to rescind your agreement, is because you made that agreement public. It's a whole other pshat. So I really want to write a thank you letter to the Masifta, because without these two comments of the Muki Yosef and the Meiri, you really don't know how to put your first foot forward here in this mission. Well, let's get to the Sefer.
I have some difficulty with the first part of
the Muki Yosef.
Yes. You say majority is related to the evidence, but you can have expert witnesses on this side and expert witnesses on this side. Dayan is the one who has to sift through it.
Yeah, I'm on your side, Jerry. So I would rather go with the Meiri, that there's a smichas das when you say something public, and that can substitute for the objective kinyan. By the way, this whole discussion that we're having here is going to be very relevant to the next mission. I just want you to keep that in mind. The next mission is about somebody called Misachi Pekubia, which is a gambler. And the Gemara says that, according to one opinion, the reason why he's disqualified for testimony is because of a principle called asmachta. And asmachta means that even though he entered into this, what do they call it? Not blackjack, what's it called?
Craps.
When you have full house.
Poker.
Even though he went into this poker game, you know, and he said, look, if I lose, I'll pay you. You know, the money is on the table. Or especially if he goes to a casino and he's playing against the house. He's playing against the house. Then certainly you would say that he made a commitment. You know, he walked in there. I don't know what exactly. I've never been to one of these places, but I suppose they make you sign something, or I don't know what.
No, sign, but your money's on the table.
Well, your money's on the table, so you certainly think that he has Gemira Stas. Nobody's stealing anything from anybody. But the Gemara says that he doesn't have Gemiras Das. The guy is, he's such a good poker player that he assumes that he's going to win.
That's called a shaitan.
Maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know enough about poker. It seems, Jerry, that there are people who I wouldn't say they always win, but they have tremendous statistical probability to win. Maybe they know how to fake you out. You know, they make it seem like they have a full house when they really have one seven of spades or something. I don't know what they do, but apparently there are professional poker players that really
millions of dollars a year. Some of these guys,
yeah, they're really raking it in. So the Gemara says that he relies on the fact that he's going to win the game. So he never really had a smichas das to pay up if he loses, and therefore he's a gazlan. But again, you see over and over again that in Dine Momenos, what's critical is something called smichas das. You know, that a person really made this commitment, that if it means he's going to have to pay, he understood from the get go that he's going to have to pay. But that, even that's not enough. You need to objectify it in some way, and that's where you need a kinyan. Now we get to the Sefer. The Sefer is going to talk about Shvua. Now, in the law of Shvua, we know that the Torah says that if there's some minimum evidence to support the claim of the Tovea of the plaintiff, then the litigant will not get off the hook, the other litigant, the defendant, unless he takes a Shvua. And that's called a Shvua Chamura. Chamura means it requires, number one, Nikitas Chefetz. You have to open up the Aron Kodesh. And B, it means that you have to mention the name of God, the holy name of God. There's another Shvua, which is called the Shvua Kala. Let's say, my father used to have a very funny Yiddish phrase, you know, I swear by my grandmother's beard, you know. By my bum is Bertel. Anyway, but what it means is, he says, I swear by my life itself. You know, my life. I swear by my life. You know, but that's the Shvua Kala. So what happens, let's say, in the following case? Reuven is the plaintiff, he's the Tovei, and he says to Shimon, I'm gonna accept the Shvua Kala. I mean, even if you're a Modu B'Mikzas, or if I have an Eid Echad, or if it's a case of a Shomer, whatever the case may be, where the Torah says you have to take a Shvua Chamura, and unless you take the Shvua Chamura, you're going to have to pay, I'm going to let you off the hook with a Shvua Kala, which is called the Chayer Roshi, and if you take that low, you know, that low profile Shvua, I'm going to let you off the hook, and you don't have to pay me. So again, we're going to have machlokas, Rabbi Meir and Chachamim, if the litigant, in this case the Tovea, made that statement, can he change his mind? Chayav l'chaveiro shvua. So there's enough evidence to support the claimant, such that the defendant will have to take a shvua chamura, and without a shvua chamura, he's not believed, and he's going to have to pay. And this is what a shvua min haTorah means, that you have to mention one of the names of God, and you have to hold on to a Sefer Torah, or maybe a Chefetz Shel Mitzvah. And he says to him, you know what, I'm going to let you off the hook, even though you chayv a Shvua Chamura, with a Shvua Kala, Omer Lo. So the plaintiff says to the defendant, all I want you to take is the following Shvua. Darli, Midar is Miloshen Shvua, take the following oath, Bechaye Roshcha. And you don't have to take a Sefer Torah into your hands or any other kind of mitzvah. You don't have to mention the name of God. Just swear by your life. And now, Reuven realizes, hey, you know what? I said something really stupid, because now Shimon is going to get off the hook and he owes me millions. And all he's going to do is take a Shvua Kala, which again, since you didn't use the name of God, that's a violation. But it doesn't come under one of the Aser Sedibris. It's not so chamur. So Omer Omer Yochel Lachzer Bo. Okay, he made a statement. He made a declaration. Now he changes his mind. So I have here one note. It's not so important, this note, but I'll just mention it. That the word dar, which we said means a shvua, he says that the word dar is a shortened form for the word neder. In other words, we drop the nun, And this is all based on the Rambam and Pirush HaMishnayos, that dar is a verb for the noun neder. And dar is like tidarli, it's like take a vow. Even though a neder is not exactly the same as a shvua, but b'loshem b'nei adam, when you say to a person swear, sometimes you tell him take a neder. You know, I want you to take a neder to back up what you say. Now, Rabos, I just keep in mind that we're going to have a tremendously profound sugya. I'm hoping that we'll figure it all out. I have most of it down, but I'm not there yet. To justify why the Mishnah needs both a Reisha and the Seifa. If I only had the Reisha in the case of a Dayan, or perhaps an Eid, of Neman Alai Ab, I wouldn't know the Seifa. About the case of Dorli al Chayeroshcha, if I only had the Seif of Dorli al Chayeroshcha, I wouldn't have known the Reish about Neman Alai Abba. What's the Chiddush both ways? And we're going to go through Rabbi Meir and then through the Chacham. Okay. Amar Rav Dimi, Berei de Rav Nachman, Berei de Rav Yosef. Don't ask me why in this case he mentions his grandfather. I think because there were many people at the time of Chazah, time of the Gemara, who fit this category called Rav Dimi Berei de Rav Nachman. Maybe they were all cousins, I don't know. But he wants to identify him as the grandson of Rav Yosef. And he's going to qualify the statement of Rabbi Meir. In other words, Rabbi Meir says that if he accepts the father as a Dayan, he can change his mind and rescind his original commitment. Says Rav Dimi, this statement, this shita of Rabbi Meir goes very far. Even in Kigon de Kabli Alei Bechat, which means that he had already two Dayanim Ksherim, and he accepted the third Dayan, who's technically disqualified, he's a Karov, as the third Dayan. And even in this case, where you have a pretty serious makeup of a Bezdin, two out of three of the judges are on the up and up. In fact, we had a Gemara at the beginning of Masechta Sanhedrin. You may remember that according to one opinion, the Gemara Shnayim Shedanu Dineim Din, if you have a unanimous decision of two judges and there was no third judge on the court, then B'dieved, that judgment is binding. Although they're called a Bezdin Chatzuf, you know, that's a chutzpah on their part, that they issued a verdict without a third Dayan. But I'm just saying that you see that, you know, two-thirds of a Bezdin is not just zero. It's a very significant part of the makeup of a Bezdin. And the whole issue was on the third Dayan, and the Bali Dinim accepted the third Dayan upon themselves. And in that case, you know, you certainly believe that his acceptance, meaning, let's call him the defendant in this case, the defendant says, you know what, I'll accept the decision of this judge as a third judge, even though this third judge is disqualified. In such a case, you certainly think that his decision or his proclamation was a very serious one. It wasn't just at the moment, you know, he had the flimsy moment, the mood that he was in at that particular point. And this would be a smichus das, because, look, let's say the third Dayan is a little bit confused because he has negias here, he's related, or maybe because he's a Roy Bakar or something along that line. Again, we're going to talk about Roy Bakar in a minute. But it means that the two other Dayanim who are qualified and they're scholars, they will prevail upon the third Dayan. So that if they only found two judges, and the third judge that they could agree upon is a relative, so in that case, you might think that that's an absolute commitment on the part of the Baldin, because he realizes that this is going to be a judgment that's on the up and up. Two out of the judges are absolutely reliable, and they'll prevail upon the third judge. And in such a case, any yochel lachzer bo, because again, even though he didn't make a kinyan, but it was an absolute commitment on his part to accept the third judge. So maybe, says Rav Dimi, you might think that Rabbi Meir would only allow chazar in the case of Shlosha Roi Baka, where there's not even one member of the court who knows the law, but if there are two members who are on the up and up, they're experts, and the third member is a Roi Baka, or the third member is technically you know, his maybe his decision-making process is tainted because he's a relative. Maybe in that case, even Rav Meir would accept the Chachamim that Eino Yochel Lachzor. So comes along Rav Dimi, and he says, no, even in this case, where he was makabel this posel as a third judge, even such a case, Rabbi Meir says that's not an absolute irretractable commitment on his part, and he can be chozer bo. That's the chiddush of Rav Dimi, and logically, you could have rejected Rav Dimi. You could have said like the Halamina Rav Dimi that Rabbi Meir would only validate Chazara in a case where we have serious doubts as to whether his decision when he accepted this Rav Bakar or this Neman Alayab was a complete Smichus Das. For example, when the Dayan is playing such a major role, either accepted that they accepted him as one Dayan as if he were three, or for example, in a case where all three Dayanim are Krovim. So he says, Neman Alayava, number one, Neman Alayavicha, number two out of the three of the Dayanim. Then Rabbi Meir allows for Chazor, but if two out of the three of the Dayanim are on the up and up, and they're absolutely qualified, then when he declares this litigant that he'll accept a third Dayan who's possible, maybe in that case it's a complete Smichas Das, and even Rabbi Meir would agree to the Chacham that Einu Yochel Lachzor. For that we need the Chiddush of Rav Dimi. Okay, now Tosus, Divar Maschil Omar, which is the second Tosus on our page, he says that if you read Rav Dimi's language carefully, it says, Kigon dekable ole bechat. Now, what does it mean, Kigon? Tosus is putting a tremendous emphasis on the word Kigon dekable ole bechat. Normally, the language of the Gemara would be lo tzricha, ela de kibla ole bechat. But what is kigon de kibla ole bechat? In other words, lo tzricha means when I want to tell you a chiddush that even in this case it applies, then you use the language lo tzricha. Again, Rav Osei, this is something that would require us to really do a search throughout Shas. And it would probably be a worthwhile search. Because he's saying that whenever you see lo tzricha, and you want to tell me a chiddush, you use the word lo tzricha lafilu, in this case he says it. But kigon is a more of a limitation. Whereas according to what we've said until now, which is all based on Rashi, the Meiri, and other Rishonim, The words of Rav Dimi are meant to be a chiddush, that Rabbi Meir goes as far as to say that even though two out of the three of Dayanim are kosher, he still can be chozer bo. So the language that would have been appropriate based on Rashi and the Meiri would have been lo tzricha el afilu de kibla le bechad. Mashma shebo loma shemeduba rak bi ofen shekibla es ovev kedayan echad. It sounds like Rav Dimi is saying kigon as not an afilu, but rather as an exclusive phrase. Kigon, only exclusively in this case, where he's makabel es aviv kedayan echad. And therefore, Tosus says in his reinterpretation of Rav Dimi, that Rav Dimi is coming to explain not the sheet of Rabbi Meir, but rather the sheet of the Chachamim in our Mishnah, who say, Eino Yochel Lachzor. And under what circumstances do the Chachamim say, Eino Yochel Lachzor? That's only in the circumstance where he was Makabel Oviv Kedayon Echad. Okay, now we have to understand, again, we're on a different turf over here. We're on the turf of Chachamim, who say, Eino Yochel Lachzor Bo. And we're saying that only in the case of Kibel es Oviv Kedayon Echad, then the Chachamim say that Eino Yochel Lachzor Bo. But let's say, for example, and this is what Rav Dimi is coming to exclude, what happens if he accepts one dayan as if he were three dayanim. Do you follow? In other words, Rav Dini is saying, yeah, there were two dayanim ksherim, and now the litigant is willing to accept the decision together with the third dayan who is pasul. In such a case, the Chachamim say there was a serious bezdin here, and we just needed the technicality of overcoming the psul of a korov in the third dayan. In such a case, his commitment was a complete, absolute gemiras das, and he's ediyach latzer. However, in kibel shiyadun bimkom shlosha dayanim, if let's say the two litigants came to an agreement that will accept the decision of one judge as if he were three judges, then modim chachomim shiachal latzer bo. That's already a whole new entity. He's not working within the framework of Bezdin as the halacha recognizes Bezdin, just to overlook a technical psul of a karo, but we have two out of three dayanim that eksherim. He's now creating a whole new entity where one dayan could serve to replace three dayanim. And not only that, who is this one dayan? He's a posel, he's a father. So now you have what I said before, tarti l'rei, so you have a double jeopardy over here. You have two negative factors, two deficiencies. Number one, he's accepting his father as a judge, and not only that, but he's accepting his father as a judge to replace three judges, and one judge will decide the case. In such a case, there is no serious smichus das without a kinyan, as we said before, and even the chacham would agree to Rabbi Meir that yochel lachzer bo. So just to summarize, the bottom line is there are two different ways Rashi and Tosfos had to interpret Rav Dimi. Rashi's learning Rav Dimi is coming to expand the sheet of Rabbi Meir, and even in a case where you have a reliable Bezdin, two out of three, even so, Rabbi Meir says he didn't have a full-fledged absolute commitment and yochel lachzer bo. According to the second shot, which is Tosfos, Rav Dimi is coming to qualify the shita of the Chacham, and when did the Chacham say that it was a serious all-out commitment? And that's because he has two out of the three of the Dayanim. Just one second. Right. That's because he has two out of the three of Dayanim Sherim, and he adds a third Dayan to the Bezdin, who's technically possible with Torah's Karov. Then the Chachamim say that he made an outright commitment and any of the Lachsa. But if Lu Yitzur, he would say that my father could judge this case alone, where there's a two strikes against you. Number one, it's a Dayan possible. Number two, he's accepted as one Dayan. That's already creating a whole new entity which the Torah doesn't recognize at all. It's not even a fledgling, a beginning of a Bezdin here. Then even the Chacham would agree, Yochel Lachzer bo. That's the sheet of Tosfos. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Alright. Now this, Rabosai, is the beginning of a very, very, very challenging sugya. We have about 3 minutes left. I just want to give a bit of an introduction to the sugya, so that maybe during the course of the day, before we meet again tomorrow, Yirtzeh Hashem, you'll be able to prepare this and figure this out. Okay, there's something called Machal Lecha and there's something called Etei Lecha. Now, Machal Lecha means that the Tovea is willing to alleviate the Nitba of what normally would have been an obligation to pay. That's called mechila. So you owe me money, according to the strict letter of the law, and I say machalacha. There's another case where the nitba, the defendant, says etein lecha. He says that according to the strict letter of the law, I don't have to pay you, but I'm going to pay you anyway. So again, in both cases, there was a declaration, a proclamation that would generate a chiyuv shalokidin, that's not based on the law. But there's two fundamentally different cases, two permutations, so to speak. There's one case where it's the Tovea who has all the rights based on the Jewish law to sue a person and collect damages, and he says, Machalacha. The other case is where a person says, Etein lecha, that means the defendant or the nitba says, technically I don't have to pay you, but under certain circumstances I hereby commit myself to pay you, even though I'm not chayev, I don't have to pay you. Now I'm going to ask you the following question, so that we'll be all on the same page. In which of these two cases is there more of an inclination, more of a logic to say that it's absolutely binding? Which sounds like it should be closer to be binding, meaning that you cannot change your mind? It's cut and it's sealed and signed and geendigt. It's finito. The case of machul lecha, the case of etein lecha, is more binding. Excellent. Now, I don't know, Jerry, if you know, you play Russian roulette, we were talking about poker before, there's a 50% chance you get the right answer. But I believe, honestly, that your intuition serves you very well. Mechila is something that's absolutely recognized by halacha. Even though, as I said before, and that was the premise underlying the Nebuki Yosef when we discussed it, that the Torah doesn't recognize promises. Those are words. You have to solidify them, concretize them, and objectify them with a kinyan. However, there is one exception in Choshen Mishpat, where words are very, very weighty and very expensive. And that's called mechila. So for example, Jerry, I owe you $1,000. And I come to you and I say, Jerry, you know, it's been difficult lately, you know, they haven't been paying me, whatever it is. I can't come up with $1,000. If you use two words, machalacha, that's it, finito, nothing to talk about.
In your case, I wouldn't do it.
Okay. I don't blame you for that. Especially if it's a significant sum and it was not a Canadian dollars, but American dollars. But, yeah. But I'm just saying, all you need is those two words, machalacha. Now, it could be that later on you'll say, I deny it, I never said machalucha, prove to me, and maybe the burden of proof would have to be on me to prove that there were witnesses who heard you say, maybe they were walking by and they heard you from a window and they heard you say those magic words, machalucha. But bottom line is that machalucha is absolutely binding. Why? It's not like etein lecha. In etein lecha, you're creating a new chiv that doesn't exist. That requires a kinyan. There's no shibud, there's no ischaibus. Words alone are cheap. But in the case of machalacha, what I'm doing is a siluk. Siluk means I'm just removing myself from collecting a chov. And in that case, mechila means siluk. I remove myself from that kind of thing. So I'll give you an example. Let's say a man marries a woman, and by virtue of the ksuba, he has to support her. That's called lefarnasa. That's one of the chiyuve mizonos. It's called in the technical language, the Gemara Ksubas. Now, she is a psychiatrist. She gets $500 for just sitting there, supposedly listening, while you're laying in the couch. I'm not trying to be cynical, but... So she's a shrink. She has a great, great income. And she says to him, at the time of the Ksuba, she says, machalacha. You don't have to support me. Baruch Hashem, I'm a wealthy woman. Now, the Gemara actually has these cases. You would think that that's all very contemporary. Today, women are making more than men, in so many different fields. But back in the time of the Gemara, it was like, a married woman was totally dependent upon her husband for support. But she said the words, machalacha. And that's fine. So again, if the Nitba is saying to the Tovea, you know what, I'm going to pay you even though you don't have ample evidence to force me to pay you, that's already etein lecha. Then yochel lachzor bo, because you cannot create a commitment to pay money without a kinyan. But in the case of machul lecha, where the Tovea says to the Nitba that even if you have to pay me, for example, you don't have a shmua, you want to just say chayiroshi, I'm going to let you off the hook, that's already mechila. That's already binding. So tomorrow, Mirz Hashem, we're going to try to take these two cases of machalacha and etemacha. But I just wanted to give you a little bit of a taste of it. Okay, then? So if I don't see you before you light Hanukkah lift, then have a freilich and Hanukkah. Everyone should have a wonderful Hanukkah. Yesterday I spoke here twice, and my theme was that Hanukkah is a pretty serious holiday. It's not all about just... you know, playing Chareke Geld, and which might make you Pasuliedis. But anyway, I mean, it's not just about, you know, all the celebrations and the family get-togethers and so forth, the latkes, and the, here they call it Sufganiyot, you know, all that stuff that is not very healthy for you. But anyway, Chanukah is a pretty serious business, because the Mefarshim, the Sfarim, write that Chanukah is the end of the period of judgment that started Rosh Hashanah, led up to Rosh Hashanah Rabbah, and the clincher is Chanukah. So we should be Zolcha Bidin on these days of Chanukah.